Good evening. As New York begins to flatten the curve, Governor Cuomo warns of a second wave. Public health plans and the way out of the crisis and health care for all, is it inevitable? With these and other stories, I'm Paul DiRienzo with some of the news for Friday, April 10th, 2020. The worldwide death toll from the coronavirus surge passed 100,000 on Friday. The epidemic in the United States cut a widening swath through New York City and spread out through the 20 million people living in the tri-state area. Officials are recording some of the worst outbreaks in the country in New Jersey, Long Island, and Connecticut, even as public health officials were optimistic that the number of new infections was declining. Meanwhile, the United States is poised to overtake Italy as the country with the highest number of dead, although the true number of fatalities due to COVID-19 may never be known. With Christians around the world heading into Easter weekend, public religious leaders alike urged people to stay home, warning that violating the lockdowns and social distancing rules could cause the virus to come storming back. In New York, Governor Andrew Cuomo warned that international experience shows the crisis is far from over.
There's going to be a second wave. Let's look at the countries that have gone through this reopening process and what can we learn from them, right? Well, we have to start to reopen. Let's look at what the other countries who have gone before us, what they did, what worked, and what didn't work. And when you take just a cursory review, you see caution signs. Hong Kong appeared to have the virus under control. They let its guard down. The virus came back. Hong Kong recorded the biggest rise in cases and a new wave of infections. Is that true? Could it happen here? Article yesterday, Italy has seen a bump in the number of cases. Before we take a step, make sure we are more informed and more aware than we were in the past. They're talking about a second wave for Singapore. You go back and you look at the 1918 flu epidemic. That was over 10 months. There was a first wave. There was a second wave. The second wave was worse than the first wave because the virus mutated. Third peak, and the whole experience was 10 months. Well, is there any extrapolation to where we are today? I don't know the answers. This is not what I do. It's not what a state does. But we know the questions, and we should have the questions answered before we take a step forward. Because, yes, no one has been here before. These are totally uncharted waters. But we do know that none of this is predetermined, and it is all a function of our actions. We are in total control of our destiny here. What we do will affect literally life and death for hundreds of people. So where do we go from here? Excuse me. First, keep doing what we're doing. Stay home, because that works. We are flattening the curve. We must continue to flatten the curve. We have to get testing to scale. That is an entirely new exercise. It's something we still haven't done well in this country. And we need both diagnostic testing and antibody testing. And we need millions and millions of them. And we need them in a matter of weeks, not months. We have to be more prepared as a nation. We should never go through this scramble that we went through with states competing against other states to buy masks from China. I mean, we should just never have been here in the first place, but certainly we should never be here again. And then let's make sure we study the waters ahead and proceed with caution before we set off on the next journey. And when we talk about reopening, let's study the data and let's look at what has happened around the world and let's make sure the best health minds in the country are giving us their best advice. How do we go forward? We stay New York tough. New York tough means more than just tough. It means discipline, means unified, means loving. and it means smart.
Cuomo has repeatedly warned that even as new hospital admissions level off, the numbers of people dying would continue to grow for some time in the grim math of the pandemic. Cuomo said the state's deaths rose 777 to more than 7,800 as of this morning. But Cuomo added a ray of hope. For the first time since mid-March, hospitalizations are slowing, with 290 new patients in a single day, compared with daily increases of more than 1,000 last week. As of Friday, Nassau County had a total of over 700 deaths. Bergen County, New Jersey, and Westchester County, New York had about 400 each. Essex County, New Jersey, and Suffolk County, New York both recorded more than 350, while Fairfield County, Connecticut had about 180 deaths. Internationally, Spain recorded 605 more deaths, its lowest figure in more than 2 weeks, bringing its overall toll to more than 15,800. Italy reported 570 additional deaths for a total of more than 18,800. In Washington, President Trump and his administration have been laying the foundation to reopen parts of the U.S. economy as early as May 1st. Trump's been feeling rising pressure over unemployment numbers rivaling those during the Great Depression. Meanwhile, a consensus is reportedly building between some conservative and liberal health professionals over a roadmap out of the crisis. Two plans, one by the Conservative American Enterprise Institute and the other by the Liberal Center for American Progress, have been published in the last few days. Both reports came to surprisingly similar recommendations. At a news conference by the Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health, health experts described their plans for a way out. Dr. Kelly Henning, who leads the public health program at Bloomberg Philanthropies, says testing is a crucial first step.
Countries or communities have access to testing. Those who are ill, the cases, the people who are exhibiting symptoms, are generally being prioritized for testing. And then after those people are well covered with testing availability, then there's the movement out to testing contacts and others who may be at risk, or people with less severe symptoms. So first testing those who are ill enough to access hospitals and medical care, perhaps testing next those who have less symptoms but lesser so, and then moving to contacts of those who are ill. Ideally, we'd have enough testing to do all of those things, but in some cases, we really haven't had the opportunity to have access to enough testing to do everything at once.
And Dr. Caitlin Rivers from the Center for Health Security at the Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health says a commitment to public health is a central task.
One of the big activities we need to be undertaking now is scaling up our public health system in order to accommodate the volume of people that we will need to track in order to make sure that they are able to stay home and have what they need to stay home, breaking chains of transmission specifically focused on people who are sick and their close contacts rather than on everybody staying home. In order to scale up those programs, it's a huge undertaking. There's a lot of infrastructure to be put in place, and we can't just do that in one place. It really needs to be filled up in every community, and so it's going to depend on how quickly we're able to get that rolling. And it's not just that. There's also testing. Testing capacities are still a major issue in many communities in the United States, and without reliable diagnostic testing and voluminous diagnostic testing, we're not going to be able to really take that case-based approach because there will be people who are sick that we're not able to appropriately identify. And so we do need to make sure that we have all four of these criteria set out before we consider moving to phase two. And those criteria, again, just to recap, are declining incidence for at least 2 weeks, which means every day for 2 weeks we would like to see fewer cases, enough testing for everybody who has symptoms, enough healthcare capacity to make sure that everybody who is sick is able to receive the standard of care and that the healthcare workers are able to care for them safely with enough personal protective equipment, and again, enough public health capacity to be able to take on that contact tracing. There now seem to be over 1 million tests run each week in the United States, which I think is a great development, but we're still seeing that a very high fraction of those tests are coming back positive, 20, 30, 40%, maybe even more in some communities. And that's telling me that we haven't really found the edges of our outbreak yet and that we need to continue pushing and continue scaling up. Just as a point of comparison, in South Korea, which has done a very good job using case-based interventions to control their outbreak, only about 2% of their tests come back positive. And in Germany, this data is a couple weeks old, but as of a couple weeks ago, about 7% of their tests are coming back positive. So when you're seeing 20, 30, 40% of tests coming back positive in the U.S., it tells me we need to keep expanding capacity, expanding testing, and finding more cases. But I do think we need to focus very energetically on things that are inside our control. And again, going back, I think right now it's staying home. And we also need to be thinking again about the pieces and the capabilities we need to put in place for when there is an opportunity to move to more targeted interventions. What we're seeing is that we're going to need really robust data-driven decision-making in order to control this pandemic, because we've never really faced a situation like this before. So I think, as I think your question is alluding to, we should also be thinking now about how we should optimize those systems and what new capabilities and new expansions we need to put in place in order to optimize that. I do feel confident saying that social distancing is working. As a principle, we've seen it work in Italy, we've seen it work in New York City, we've seen it work in Washington State. And so I am confident that staying home will slow the spread. And so I think we should definitely continue doing that.
Up until now, the center of the coronavirus outbreak has been Europe and now the United States, with New York City reporting more cases than any single country. Health experts fear the next hotspots may be among some of the world's poorest countries in sub-Saharan Africa, even as Trump has threatened to cut funding to the World Health Organization in his repeated attempts to shift blame for the U.S.'s poor response to the pandemic. The World Bank says that Africa's economy could shrink by as much as 5.1% because of the pandemic. Dr. Henning.
Here in Africa, as you know, right now, there are relatively small numbers of cases being reported. But we also realize that the amount of available testing that's going on in those communities is really quite limited. And when we look at other indicators like pneumonia-like disease or admissions to the hospital for pneumonia in some of these less resourced countries, we are seeing increases. There's a lot of concern that this outbreak is really silently moving forward in a lot of the lower and middle income settings. The amount of testing for coronavirus, which is going on right now, is quite minimal. So that is making it difficult to understand precisely the scope and the depth of the epidemic in these localities. There are some positive developments. I'm thinking particularly of sub-Saharan Africa, where those countries have faced fairly recent, fairly large outbreaks. So Ebola certainly comes to mind, as are some of their other outbreak responses. And so the governments are taking this problem very seriously, and their ability to do things like contact tracing, where one goes out and finds all those who've been in close contact with a case, is fairly good considering their limited resources. The issues that we're going to have in these countries are very much related to lack of supplies, actually. And the most frequent request or question we get is about personal protective equipment and testing in the lower income countries.
And you're listening to the news on WBAI New York. I'm Paul DiRienzo. The managing director of health physics at the Center for American Progress is Maura Kalson. Her organization's report is titled A National and State Plan to End the Coronavirus Crisis. She says while the American Enterprise report has differences with her group's report, both agree that this is not going to be a short-term crisis and testing is going to be central.
They're not identical, but they're very similar. Step one for both is really continuing a period of pretty dramatic social distancing nationwide, and both then move on to have next steps of ramping up testing, production of personal protective equipment, and some degree of contact tracing and isolation.
Is this something that would be more than what we've been doing now, let's say in New York City?
Ideally, you'd really want this to be nationwide. The virus does not stop at state lines. There are obviously large metropolitan areas like the New York greater metropolitan area that are more than one state, but there is a complete lack of leadership at the federal level. So it's really going to be up to states to move forward to do this.
Are people in small towns across America going to have to do this?
The answer is yes. I think that really it doesn't matter where you are in this country. You really need to stay at home as much as possible and follow the advice of public health experts in your area.
What does that mean for the economy of the United States, already at depression level unemployment?
Until there's a vaccine, if we want to get back to normal, we need, without that type of disruption, we need mass testing and we need some sort of surveillance in order to allow people to know if they've come into contact with people who have been tested positive. So it's not an either or. It's not a, you know, we have to do this indefinitely. We have to do this simultaneously with ramping up testing and taking these other steps.
Does that mean what I've been hearing, things like we're going to have a barcode on our phones and we're going to get on public transport or to go to certain locations, you're going to have to show that barcode to people to get in, something along those lines?
There is no way that would be, I mean, there's no way it should be place like that, but there are ways to be able to collect some of this information in a way that reflects our constitutional rights and our civil liberty sensitivities here in the United States. There needs to be a lot of protections. Data should not be collected by the federal government, for example. It should be collected by public health nonprofits. It needs to be completely stripped of any identifying information. It needs to be automatically deleted. I mean, this is going to be a large task, but there are already people working on this, some states working on it. And we have to do it the right way, but the trade-off is really trying to reopen the economy too quickly, and then that will then in turn cause another flare-up to happen. And you really, it's not an either-or with the economy or public health. It's we have to do these things in concert together.
If we go back to work too early and there's another flare-up, then we have to all run back inside, and doing that repeatedly might be more disruptive than just doing it one time.
You need targeted, gradual lifting of restrictions, but you need to do that in a really evidence-based, educated way, which is where the testing and being able to really figure out where people are symptomatic and where people are, and making sure that those people understand that they're tested positive because there aren't enough tests right now, and then make sure that those people are isolated from others in their area.
One of the reports mentioned America's pretty individualistic place. It's already consumed with conspiracy theories left and right about this. And the president of the United States is, I think, fair to say, not helping. How are we going to do this?
President Trump's actions during this entire pandemic, starting before when he first had his initial, when he was first warned of this, have been absolutely ruinous. And that's why it's fallen on states and in states where the governors have not acted, localities, to really do this. We're seeing a lot of leadership everywhere at every level but the presidency and his administration. And we're also seeing bipartisan leadership. I mean, Ohio has a Republican administration, and they have taken this threat extraordinarily seriously.
What's the worst case scenario, which I hate to ever ask, but in this case, we have to ask that question. What's the worst case scenario?
The worst case scenario is really an endless cycle of infection waves until we have a vaccine. And you would have the wave of infection and economic depression followed by the same thing. So we need to really work together to stay home for as long as we need to really, again, ramp up testing, ramp up these other items. And we really need to take those steps to prevent that second wave. And eventually, it's not easy, but we're going to return to some degree of normal life.
And how long of a time period do you think?
The biggest issue right now is that this goes back to the lack of leadership with President Trump. Right now, there's a real danger by him contradicting experts. He's now saying he wants business as usual on May 1st. We don't have the capacity to build up what we need to do to reopen May 1st. We don't have any alternative to these stay-at-home orders right now. We don't have the mass testing. We don't have contact tracing. We don't have targeted quarantines. Other countries have used to suppress the virus. When we start reopening depends on the information we have and analysis of that information, but we don't even have the ability to have that information yet.
What country is most doing things the right way that the U.S. could emulate?
South Korea is very much the model of flattening the curve. However, South Korea's plan is not politically, constitutionally permissible, really, here in the United States. Germany is an example of a democracy where the increases in infections have leveled off slightly. They have much more testing than we do. But in contrast to President Trump, there are glimmers of hope there.
That's Maura Kalson. She's the managing director of health physics of the Center for American Progress. Meanwhile, Dr. Anthony Fauci said Friday that United States health officials were preparing to roll out blood tests approved by the Food and Drug Administration that will identify Americans who have been exposed to the coronavirus and may harbor immunity. So-called antibody tests are already being used in countries like China, Germany, and Finland to track the spread of the coronavirus, but the U.S., which is by far the largest number of reported cases to date, has yet to make them widely available. And as a staggering 17 million Americans file for unemployment benefits, Federal Reserve Chair Jerome Powell said Thursday that the U.S. economy is in an emergency and is deteriorating with alarming speed. Last week alone, 6.6 million Americans applied for unemployment benefits, a number unthinkable a few months ago. An analysis published Tuesday in the prestigious Annals of Internal Medicine added a new dimension to the crisis. More than 7 million Americans are expected to lose their health insurance during the coronavirus pandemic, while more than 1.5 million are already estimated to have lost coverage. The study was conducted by researchers at Harvard Medical School and the City University of New York's Hunter College. One of the authors is Dr. Steffi Woolhandler, primary care MD in the Bronx and assistant professor at Hunter College.
People lose their jobs. They lose their health insurance coverage. About one-sixth of all people who file for unemployment claims will go from being insured while they were on the job to being uninsured now that they're laid off. Additionally, for every one person who loses their health insurance because they were laid off from their own job, there will be almost one other dependent who gets laid off. So for 100 laid off workers, there will be about 83 dependents who also lose their coverage. And for that reason, we think that there will be about 7 million workers who will lose their own coverage because of layoffs, and an additional 6.5 million family members and dependents will lose their coverage. And that's just by June 30th, the end of this fiscal quarter.
Doesn't that affect the insurance companies as well? I mean, they are supposed to make their money by insuring people. If they're not insuring people, they're not making money.
Perhaps that's true, but many of the insurance companies are finding that nobody among their insured is using things like elective surgery and elective procedures that are very expensive. So things like a joint replacement or eye surgery that can usually be postponed, nobody's using anything like that. So the insurance companies, despite all the people who are desperately ill in hospitals, are not finding that they're spending that much money these days.
Woolhandler adds that the biggest changes often happen at times of greatest crisis. She says national health insurance came to Europe on the heels of the World War and political revolution.
Most European national health insurance systems were installed in the time of World War II or shortly thereafter. Several of the southern European countries threw off their dictators in the 70s and then immediately enacted national health programs after they'd had their political revolutions. Often big changes come after big upheavals in society. I think that's really true. And we're certainly seeing that kind of upheaval right now. As you know, unemployment levels are similar to what was seen in the Great Depression. And we are facing a really life-threatening illness for which many, many Americans are going to need medical care in order to survive. Never made any sense to tie health coverage to employment. People are too sick to work. It's crazy to have your health insurance tied to your work. So that never made sense, even in the best of times, to have health insurance that was part of your employment contract. But in the worst of times like these, it's sheer insanity to continue with a private insurance system based on work.
Mm-hmm. If you were too sick to work, then, you know, the government dealt with you on the dole or something.
If the government really dealt with you, that would be one thing. In nations like Germany, it looks like your health insurance comes through your job. But the minute you lose your job, you can be enrolled in a community-based plan that has the exact same doctors, the exact same premiums, the exact same benefits. Really, your health coverage is mandated by the German government, controlled by the German government, whether it comes through your workplace or not. That's what they have in Germany, but we've never had a system like that in the United States. We've never had that. The minute people lose their job, their health insurance is up at the end of the month, and people have to scramble to see if they can get Medicaid, if they can get on a spouse's insurance. But in many instances, there is no option, which is why 16% of people who lose their jobs lose their health insurance coverage. and have nothing. They have nothing in terms of health insurance the month later. That system never made any sense. It was always, in a way, a historical accident, something that was very beneficial to private for-profit insurance industry, but it never really made sense from a patient care point of view or from the point of view of families to have insurance tied to employment. And right now, where we're on a massive scale seeing that illness is taking away people's jobs and taking away their access to insurance, it's really utter insanity to continue with a job-based system. And we really need something like Medicare for All. We need something immediately to put everyone who doesn't have health insurance onto a federally funded program. But over the long term, we really do need to be going towards a Medicare for All system that covers all medically necessary care for everyone.
Steffi Woolhandler is primary care MD in the Bronx and assistant professor at Hunter College. And finally, former U.S. ambassador to China Gary Locke is denouncing President Donald Trump for a new campaign ad that seems to falsely imply Locke was a Chinese official. Trump's Republican reelection campaign released an ad Thursday that accused former Vice President Joe Biden, the presumptive Democratic presidential nominee, of being too cozy with China. It featured an image of Biden and Locke on a stage with U.S. and Chinese flags in the background. Locke, an Asian American, said Friday that Trump and his team are fanning hatred at a time when hate crimes and discrimination against Asian Americans are on the rise. He said in a statement that the Trump team is making it worse and that Asian Americans are Americans, period. And that's some of the news for Friday, April 10th, 2020. The news was produced with Linda Perry. Our engineer is Reggie Johnson. For the WBAI News, I'm Paul DiRienzo.